Hello and welcome to edition 373 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On today's show, we'll be speaking with Paul McAlinden, the orchestra conductor who gathered musicians in one of the most turbulent regions on the planet, Iraq, and helped them play together. He'll be discussing his book, all about it, on the show later.
Then we'll be learning how you make art history interesting for kids. Our historian and writer Michael Bird will be discussing his book, Vincent Starry Night and Other Stories, A Children's History of Art.
And we'll welcome back the writer Travis Elbra to talk about the simple pleasures of a visit to the park. His latest book, A Walk in the Park, celebrates, Rob, exactly that.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Henry Reece Sheridan will be knocking the news look ahead straight out of the park. And we'll play some great music too. That's all coming up on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. There we have it, Tom. Here we are. It's Sunday. It's lunchtime. I'm not hungry, so I just thought I'd come into the radio studio.
There's
what about
nowhere,
you?
Rob, I'd rather be than here, especially on a Sunday lunchtime.
And
this is the radio equivalent of a roast dinner,
isn't it?
And we're serving it up right now,
isn't it? What have we got? Have we just got sort of juice? Have we got full on gravy?
No, lavish, the full works.
Lavish. Do you go for the oval plate or do you
oval
get,
plate?
Yeah, oval
full
plate.
Works.
Get more on
there.
Yeah,
get my big plate. Potatoes, crispy on the outside, soft in the middle. That could be Travis Elbra.
Yeah. Well, that's him, isn't it?
He's a metaphorical roast potato.
Travis Elbra is one of those people I greatly admire. He has a sort of hint of the Betjemans about him, a mini Betjeman.
I'm looking forward to it. Looks
a bit like Austin Powers, but with good teeth.
I'm looking forward to meeting him.
You've never met him.
I bumped into him last
weekend at the Green Man Festival that I was attending. Through the fog.
You were both at large.
I saw him through the mists of the Brecon Beacons, and I'm looking forward to seeing him in a radio studio where it's not going to be raining and we're all
normal. It shouldn't be raining in here. And we've got some musical sustenance coming up.
It's all going to be great.
I can't wait, and I won't wait
for edition 373 of the Monocle Weekly. But I suppose first we better get the news look ahead out of the way. I can see him huffing up the glass in the control room. It's Henry Reece Sheridan.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump and rock.
All right.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way Texas hop.
But how am I doing now?
Hi, Henry.
Hello, hi. On the topic of food, I've just consumed, in lieu of lunch, two ostensibly organic energy bars, which have absorbed most of the water in my mouth.
Oh, great.
So I apologise.
So really...
Henry, can I pour you a refreshing glass of water?
Please do.
Here we go. That's the sound.
Much obliged.
Okay, nice.
There you go.
I'm just going to wet the whistle.
Wet your palate with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's better, thanks, Tom.
Good, okay.
Appreciate that.
So these energy bars, were they those sort of squelchy, sort of green, organic, mushy ones?
I know what you're talking about. These were altogether more granular.
Okay.
The component part were actually quite large.
Yeah.
And in both instances...
What, they're Brazil nut?
That category of foodstuff. And in both instances, held together by a kind of viscous membrane.
Ugh.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Earlier in the week we were talking on the briefing, weren't we, about horrible words in first the English dictionary and then rude words in the Australian dictionary. I think Henry's could add very easily to both.
I don't think anybody wants a
viscous membrane.
Know much about a viscous membrane if that can help
time.
It. Especially not over a roast potato.
I don't know. I mean, with the gravy, eventually does form a viscous membrane, doesn't it?
Just
if you leave it long enough after.
Okay, no more membranes.
What about Sunday lunch?
Should we get into the news agenda?
From the 1st of September onwards to the 10th of September, the Mayor of London, our Mayor, Sadiq Khan, is going to make his first foreign trip as Mayor of London. He's going to go to the United States and Canada to meet senior politicians. I want you to evaluate how well you think Sadiq Khan, Mayor of London, would get on with the following people. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
Pretty well.
I think that'll be a meeting of kind of, you know...
Similar political views, possibly.
Metrosexual types.
Popular people.
Yeah.
I think you're right, Tom. I think in terms of the optics of their political sensibilities, very similar.
We're saying Justin and Sadiq.
Yeah.
I think so.
Okay.
This next one's interesting. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel.
Now, I've heard of him. Is he a bit of a fiery character, isn't he?
He's
a big character, but he was a pal of Obama, wasn't he, when Obama was still knocking
around? He was a pal
of
Obama, but since he's in the mayoralty of Chicago, he has proven a controversial figure. First of all, to do with, I think there's some funny money stuff going on.
Right.
And also with regards to his reaction to some of the ostensible misdeeds of the Chicago police while he's been
that's
there.
Tricky, yeah.
A tricky one.
I'm
not particularly though, loved figure on
no,
Manuel.
No, but I'm going to say he's called Ram, Sadiq's called Khan. They sound kind of similar.
Yeah.
I think they're going to get on famously.
He's then going to head to New York for a sit-down, in the words of the press release I'm reading, with New York Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Right.
Go on.
What's Bill's kind of vibe? I'm not very knowledgeable about Bill.
Henry, I'm not sure. Bill de Blasio, very big character. I'm not quite sure him and Sadiq Khan will see eye to eye.
I'm not sure either. And finally, there are also hopes that the mayor, Sadiq Khan, could meet Bill Slick Willie Clinton.
Oh, they are going to get on like an absolute house on fire.
But who wouldn't with Bill, you know? Yeah. There we go.
I thought you had a more Bill Clinton appropriate sound on your magic music
What
box.
Was the most Slick...
That's the one.
That's
okay,
the one.
There we are.
Fantastic.
So that's good. So he's got... So 3 out of 4 ain't bad, to misquote M. Loaf.
Looks like he's going to have a... looks like he's going to have a good time. I've got 2 more stories.
M. Loaf, underrated.
M. Loaf been explained?
In the annals of musical history. Everyone knows who M. Loaf is.
Can we talk about M. Loaf quickly?
Please do.
Tom, can you explain who M. Loaf is? He is the same as Meatloaf, not quite the same.
So when I was at school, there was a colleague of mine who had a pencil case.
A colleague? Do you have colleagues at school?
Or whatever. What's it called?
Peer.
A peer. And he was a big fan of Meatloaf. We only learned this because he wanted to write Meatloaf on his pencil case, but it was too compact, so he just wrote M. Loaf.
Now, was M spelt...
Just
the
letter.
Rob, sorry,
I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
Just the letter M.
Okay.
M. Loaf. As if he was Mr. Loaf and Meat was his first name.
As if he was some kind
Loaf
of...
Loaf M. Present.
Exactly.
Like, roll call.
Some kind of academic being cited in the paper.
Yeah, or just, I don't know, you know, works in a bank or something. Mr. Loaf.
M. Anyway, Loaf 43.
M. Loaf.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, Rob just quoted M. Loaf right then.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
This next one's for Rob, and the one after that is for you, Tom.
Okay.
So, from the 28th of August until the 5th of September... Burning Man Festival is taking place in the Nevada desert. Now, all I know about this is the popular media characterization of it, which is that a bunch of Google executives go to the desert and put raw ginger up each other's bottoms. Now,
okay.
Is that a fair characterization to your mind?
Rob, apparently the floor is yours for this one.
Why is it me? Okay. One of my mates, Michelangelo, good name, has been to this a couple of times, and I think I can exactly imagine that. He's a hippie who's got quite a decent job, so maybe that's exactly what goes on there. I can only agree with your assumption.
Spot on. Okay. Is what you're, can I have a sound?
Yeah. Or do you want something else?
I want something a bit more assertive. That's
that apparently
that's
is the
sound. Ginger sound.
That's the sound of ginger insertion. What's the one for me, Henry? I can hardly wait.
From the 28th of August or the 29th of August, 2 whole days. It's only Nebworth Classic Motor Show.
Why is that not for me?
Is that your thing? I thought you were the car man. I'm looking at Tom.
No, I'm a secret petrol head. That's fine.
Yeah.
What kind of marks featuring everything from the length and breadth of the aisle and the world?
Well, it says there's an auto jumble. Do you know what that is?
No, move on.
I hope that has nothing to do with ginger. And live music with some great classic songs from the 50s, 60s and 70s. Not before or after.
Good, that's fine.
Just those 3 decades.
Those are the classic motoring decades.
I was hoping that you were going to be able to impart some motoring wisdom. Maybe you've been there. I don't know.
No, I haven't.
Oh, really?
However, you know, classic motors, everyone enjoys them. Just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen some astonishing sales.
Go on.
A Jaguar sold for £16 million over on
that's
the west coast of the
US.
That's
a lot of money for a car, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite dear. But I can see why. If I had limitless funds... I'd be getting involved in the...
You wouldn't go to Burning Man, actually.
Yeah. In London, aren't they? Yeah.
No, I wouldn't go to Burning Man because of all that ginger that's left lying around. But I tell you, I'd buy a classic auto or two.
Would you drive it to Burning Man?
You could do, couldn't you?
You could.
I'd worry it might overheat. You know, if I was driving a
sort of beautiful
1954
D-type
Gullwing Mercedes 300, I'd worry that it would just...
Yeah.
Steam would start coming out of it.
Is there a car sound? There must be a car sound.
I think it's on the other one.
Does anything that conjures the world of transport... In a manner of speaking. It's pretty good, isn't it?
That's a very versatile sound.
It's quite good, isn't it? Yeah.
I think we should leave it there. Thanks for being with us as always, Henry Rhys Sheridan. making a collective of musicians play in time, play in tune, and simply get along is a tricky job at the best of times. But what if those musicians are also trying to make life work in a region savaged by war, sectarianism, and ethnic tensions? If you're going to try and form an orchestra, a place like Iraq might be the trickiest place of all to go about it. But luckily, nobody told that to our first guest, the conductor, Paul McAlinden.
Having worked with musical organisations as diverse as the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra and the Düsseldorf Symphonica in the past, back in 2009, Paul found himself looking for his next job. The answer was to help form the National Youth Orchestra of Iraq, which he led until 2014. Paul is now retracing the orchestra's journey in a new book, Upbeat, the story of the National Youth Orchestra of Iraq. And he joins us now to tell us about that story. Paul, welcome to the programme.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Rob. Great to see you both.
This is a fantastic idea for a book. I mean, it's kind of autobiographical, but it's also telling the story of the kids that were in the orchestra.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, an orchestra can so easily metaphorically stand for unity. Was that the first thing you had to do to get people in the same room from different ethnicities and religions or sections of the same religion?
Yeah.
Was that your first kind of job, I wonder?
What we were looking for across the whole of Iraq, and this is back in 2009, where theoretically the country was just beginning to pull itself out of war, even though Baghdad was still pretty hot when it came to terrorism,
yeah.
Was to try and find people who could play in the first place. And these were young people who, during their teenage years, for example, had found their way to picking up an instrument, wanted to learn Bach or Beethoven, and were mimicking YouTube. That was their way of learning how to play classical music because there were no teachers left. So we were basically auditioning by putting the word out on Facebook and Twitter and the usual social media channels and asking people to make a small video of themselves playing. And then they had to upload that to YouTube in Arabic, which I could then see in YouTube in Germany, where I was currently living at that time. So it sounds like a very straightforward thing to do. But back in 2009, anything to do with a landline in Iraq was a complete waste of time.
Also, it doesn't sound that easy a thing to do, to be honest.
it certainly had its hurdles.
Yeah.
But wireless LAN was just beginning to pick up in Iraq. It could take up to 10 hours to get 5 minutes down the line, and that's if the electricity didn't cut off and send you back to square one. So it was a huge labour of love and a big challenge for a lot of them to just get their videos to me so I could choose people who I could trust would get to the beginning, to the end of the concert in one piece.
And Paul, what about some of the privations? You talk about them there, whether it's simply, you know, having power. But what about the privations that a lot of these young people had been through? I mean, I think in the book you mentioned sort of, you know, literally sort of instruments melting, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
How heavily stacked against these kids was the deck in terms of getting anywhere, even getting started on this course?
I think it depends very much on where in Iraq you were living. In the Kurdistan region of Iraq, which is relatively liberal by Middle Eastern standards, it was somewhat easier and a great deal safer than the rest of Iraq. Baghdad was the real problem. It had the Baghdad School of Music and Ballet, which Saddam Hussein ironically supported. So there were Russian ballet teachers and Russian music teachers there. But during the war, you had, of course, the fall of that government, replaced by a very religiously oriented government. So there was a period of time when my players in Baghdad were skulking around the streets trying to go from home to rehearsal with, you know, paper bags around their instruments to hide the shape of a violin, because people would think it might be a bomb or worse, a violin, because it was a Western instrument. And there are certain interpretations of religion that suggest that music is haram, forbidden. So they were dealing with those extremist tendencies. On top of that, they were just dealing with the fact that they had no teachers, that it was dangerous to go outside their front door. And if you cut down the mobility of any musician, every musician knows this, you're killing the career. If they can't move around safely to go to rehearsals, to perform, you might as well just pack it in.
I mean, you mentioned in your first answer, Paul, that there was obviously a bit of residual passion for music and ability to play it, that kids had the instruments,
yeah,
even rudimentary ones, or, you know, they weren't exactly rocking out with their Stradivariuses,
yeah, yeah,
under the Iraqi heat.
Yep.
So were you heartened that this thing existed, that you had kids with, as I say, that residual passion for music that could be taught and that could be corralled into becoming a youth orchestra?
Oh, I was more than heartened. We could manage to put together an orchestra of some 33 young players. And by young, I was talking between 18 and 25. But one must also remember that there was a real desperation from these young people. They had been let down so often by the corruption in Iraq. Lots of big organisations would promise gigantic things to them, and then it would never materialise because the money would slip down some official's back pocket. So suddenly something was turning up and coming along, being organised by myself and the British Council and Zuhal Sultan, who founded the orchestra, which actually happened. And this in itself was a miracle. So there was a real hunger from these young people to bury their differences and their communication problems and come together and, with a great deal of earnestness and intent, somehow make this work. And it was also a huge act of faith. I was guessing that they would be able to play it. They were guessing that I would be able to help them. And we were just learning about each other in this intense hotbed of a summer course, day by day.
Paul, let's jump to these, you know, the sort of the tours that you go on. Obviously, this features in the book, but maybe you can give a sense to our listeners about the sense of, I don't know what it was. Is it achievement? Is it relief? Is that, how did it measure up to your other many achievements in music to sort of get this show on the road and play in, you know, European venues, for example? I mean, that must have been an extraordinary accomplishment. How did you and the rest of the gang kind of make sense of what was happening?
I think the rest of the gang, the players themselves, didn't really grasp the big culture differences. Flying from Iraq, many of them had never left Iraq because getting a visa to get out in the first place, again a mobility issue. Then going to Germany in 2011 to the home of Beethoven, the city of Bonn, where we have Beethovenfest, who invited us. That was a gigantic culture shock. Suddenly everything in Germany was organised and everything worked and everything, all the streets were clean and there were no checkpoints every 100 metres. So for them, this was just like a paradise. And it was also in September. So it was an autumnal German day with a relatively nice, comfortable European temperature, which didn't crack their instruments or knock them out of tune. So for the first time, they could play in tune because they were outside of a climate that allowed them to do so. There were many, many culture shocks along that line. Even for those who spoke fluent English, still placing themselves in this environment in Europe, the heartland of classical music, which is what they so desperately loved, was a massive eye-opener. All the things that they struggled to achieve every single day were just effortless in this other world.
You mentioned Beethoven there. I don't know. Maybe we'll go on maybe to ask you about the programme and listen to a bit of it. I think you've got a clip of something. I mean, so many of Beethoven's ideas were about the Enlightenment. So many of the classical era, classical composers and the romantic composers came out of that idea of Enlightenment thoughts, of love, of not of sex, not of haram ideas necessarily, but Enlightenment doesn't go down that well with a lot of these guys that are ruling the Middle East at the moment. Mm-hmm. So was that tied up? Is there an intellectual idea in the music and of your students, your orchestra's understanding of that music, of not just the notes, the fact that the music is powerful and emotional and a beautiful work of art, but what it meant to Beethoven, what it meant to European audiences in the 18th century and 17th century?
I think it's a very good question, and I would begin it by saying that the Iraq that the young players now live in is not the Iraq that existed 50, 60 years ago. Back then, it was a very intense intellectual centre. It was a huge cultural centre. Ironically, it was Iraqi Jews who were the most successful and prominent musicians in Baghdad. This was back in the 40s and 30s. So there was a long tradition of mixing cultures, of a Babylonian, multilingual and multicultural intellectual community. That no longer exists because of the brain drain, which continues to this day. So going to Beethovenfest and to Bonn and to the heartland of German philosophy and to the heartland of the Enlightenment was simply a different feeling, a different way of placing their understanding of music in an historical context, because many of them were playing purely out of raw talent and purely out of an intuitive, deep love of the sound of music. And then to suddenly realise that learning about the history of what they were doing was hugely important to connecting them to Enlightenment thinking, to Beethoven's own striving and struggling against his own deafness, against the Napoleonic invasion, which Beethoven puts into the music of his fifth piano concerto. So there's a whole history there which I think the players took on much more seriously the more physically close they got to the heartland of the music they loved.
We've heard so much about it, and it's I'm sure whet everyone's appetites for a clip. We'll hear it first, and then Paul can describe, maybe his ears are keen enough to describe where even it was from. A nice dynamic passage there, Paul. As I said, maybe this was recorded in Baghdad. Maybe this was out on the road. Where was that from? Sounded like a bit of Beethoven.
It was a bit of Beethoven. Yeah. It was the opening to Symphony No. 8 in Grand Théâtre de Provence in Aix-en-Provence. That was our last concert in 2013. And Beethoven 8 was a huge undertaking for us technically. It certainly had the rawness as if it were the very first performance of that piece. And I was conducting it in three beats to a bar, which you're not really supposed to do. But the kids wanted me to do that for the sake of keeping control and order. It's really in one in a bar and a little bit faster than that. Yeah. But nevertheless, it had a raw, vital, visceral energy from the orchestra that really took our rather over-refined Grand Théâtre de Provence audience aback. We were also in a festival with the National Youth Orchestras of Germany, France, Spain and Italy. And we were the National Youth Orchestra of Iraq. So we had all these Rolls-Royce orchestras with the best players, the creme de la creme of these countries, playing Wagner and Debussy and also Sacre du Printemps, The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, which blew us away. But what we were able to lend to that festival was an unashamed, unabashed and quite uninhibited, and partly because it's rather unschooled, direct raw energy to the whole sense of Beethoven, which I think Beethoven would have, at least if he hadn't heard it, felt it through the floor.
Paul, to bring this story kind of more up to date, and it is difficult because there's these wonderful, you know, to hear the music and to hear you talk so passionately about it, there is a sort of a sadness about the situation, of course, in Iraq, which means that this work couldn't continue. Mm. Having seen that process over five years, yeah, actually working with the orchestra, I don't know, how raw is that feeling of something really important taken away now? Do you sort of think about it every day, or is it something where it's given you enough optimism, I guess, looking into the future about, you know, a brighter hope maybe for what might lie in store for those players and others like them?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really complicated and tricky question. I think the bottom line is, at the moment, there's no happy ending for the National Youth Orchestra of Iraq. It's reality. And there's not much of a happy ending for the nation of Iraq either right now. So one has to take that on board. Unfortunately, I have to really say that the most powerful characteristic that all the players shared and continue to share is their resilience. Mm. One wouldn't wish them to be that resilient to just keep their music going through the situation they're in now, but I do at least know they've got that. Without a shadow of a doubt, they are the toughest young classical musicians in the world. Much tougher than I'll ever be. So it's a question of knowing that when things eventually settle down and return to some semblance of normality in that part of the world, they're all still alive, they're all still safe, I know that much, and we chat away on Facebook sometimes, and I see the pictures of them performing with the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra in Baghdad, so that's still going on. They will eventually become the cultural leaders, and they'll remember those 5 years that we had together and what they saw outside of their world in Iraq. And I think that's what heartens me most of all. They have tremendous resilience. They have a depth of love of classical music that I haven't seen in any Western student before. And I just know that for as long as they keep hold of that, things will get better.
Well, Paul, congratulations on that work and congratulations on the book.
Cheers.
As well. I mean, it sounds to me like a bit of an act of catharsis as well, and a bit of a gift to all your students, actually finishing the work as much as going out there and doing it in the first place. And the book is called Upbeat, The Story of the National Youth Orchestra of Iraq. Paul, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Tom.
Time for some new music now. This is new from Hamilton Lighthouser of The Walkman and Rostam from Vampire Weekend, and this is called A Thousand Times.
I had a dream that you were mine. I've had that dream a thousand times. A thousand times.
That was A Thousand Times by Hamilton Lighthouser and Rostam from Vampire Weekend. You're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly.
Kiosk Cafe has arrived in London. From the founders of Monocle comes a newsstand and coffee bar concept inspired by Europe's finest city street kiosks. There's a great selection of magazines and newspapers, of course, including print-on-demand titles from all around the world, making Kiosk Cafe in Paddington a real celebration of the best in print and paper. And there's more. With all-pressed coffee and travel essentials from some of Monocle's favorite brands available too, Kiosk Cafe is the perfect spot for business travelers and visitors to London, as well as print aficionados. Come and visit us and see for yourself. Kiosk Cafe is open for business now from 7 a.m. to 1900 daily at Norfolk Place, moments from Paddington Station. Kiosk Cafe, newsstand and coffee bar. We look forward to welcoming you.
The history of art is long and complex, of course, and distilling it into one book often ends up expelling one of its most essential components, fun. So when eminent art historian, writer and lecturer Michael Bird sat down to write his latest book, A History of Art Aimed at Kids, he focused on telling the story rather than the dry academia.
And the result is Vincent Starry Night and Other Stories, A Children's History of Art. Monocle's Tom Hall met Michael earlier to learn all about it.
This is a fairly, I would say, ambitious book, especially for the demographic that it's aiming for. It kind of goes over about 40,000 years of art, is that right?
Yeah, roughly. I mean, no one quite knows when the first piece of art in the book, the little sculpture carved from mammoth ivory called the Lion Man, was made, but let's say 40,000 years ago.
And we should just add that this is for up to 9-year-olds, I believe.
Oh, I would say more like 12. I mean, it's, you know, it's, in a way, I think it's a book to share. So if you're, as you know, when I had young children, when my sons are now in their 20s, but when they were sort of 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, my wife and I, we did a lot of reading with them. And this is the kind of book, you know, Greek myths, that sort of thing. This is the kind of book that I could imagine sharing with them at that age. But I think later on, an 11, 12, even 13-year-old reading on their own, I think would have no trouble, I hope.
Yeah, and there's something very interesting about the way this book is written. I mean, it is kind of written in that slightly almost fantastical style at times. I mean, you are an art historian. You must be very conscious of telling any accidental untruths. But you have stories such as sort of told from the perspective of, say, like Jackson Pollock's wife. And
Who was a historical figure.
Yeah,
she
of
really
course,
did, Lee
of
Krasner
course,
really did
course,
exist.
Of course. And, you know, people's grandson or granddaughter sort of explaining why their grandfather paints these majestic
we
great
had
waves.
Hoku-sized grandson.
Indeed.
Yes.
You know, how did you, what did you draw on to kind of get into those sort of unusual perspectives when dealing with art? And how did you kind of approach this from a fresh perspective?
I'm not sure that it answers your question, but in a way, each story kind of told me how it wanted to be done. And I would, you know, I'd go to sleep the previous night thinking, okay, I'm going to be writing a story about an Islamic calligrapher or about Rembrandt or something. And the next morning, the story would be almost fully formed. And I did take a lot of trouble to make sure, and I hope I've made sure, that the art historical bits of the jigsaw were in the right place. But of course, with any story, and the further you go back in history, the more this is the case, there are large gaps that you have to fill with conjecture and imagination. And that's where I had a lot of fun. So I really loved writing this. And I think it brought together for me the desire to fictionalize and invent and imagine but also to kind of organize the art historical facts so that maybe they you could look at them in a slightly different slant, you know, see them afresh. That's the idea.
I mean, I was interested in also the approach that you've taken to kind of art history as a whole, because I think a lot of people, myself included, are maybe a bit guilty of assuming that really art started about 500 years ago, because, you know, that's when we sort of have this kind of frame of reference of these historical paintings that we sometimes repeatedly go to museums to see. It's like, oh, you know, I saw the Mona Lisa 20 years ago, back, because that it's kind of they're almost on a kind of on a revolving kind of schedule in our mental sort of headspaces. But obviously that is not the case, and I'd just like to let any listeners know that I know that's not the case. But it's but you know, it goes back thousands and thousands, and in your case you've written sort of back to around 40,000 years, where we have these like almost Neolithic scenes. But I was interested that we've had evidence of people going far, far back, like human inhabitants of the earth going back far, far, far further than 40,000 years. Why was it around that time that we started to leave traces of who we are in art?
It is a very, very interesting time in human evolution, sort of 40, 50, 60,000 years ago. Of course, no one's quite sure what happened when. You know, there are no written records. There's, you know, but it seems that around that time, people's brains did start to function in different ways. And as a species, we became able to imagine, to picture, to act on things that weren't actually there in front of us. And this, if you think, you know, you think people think of imagination as a kind of the fun side of life, you know, oh, it's only imaginary. But if you think about it, all scientific advances, all ability to picture something that has not yet happened, this is the imagination. And the development of language is clearly very much part of this, that you can talk to people about things they can't actually see that happened yesterday or will happen in a year's time or that sort of thing. So around, you know, people think maybe 50,000 years ago, we started to be able to do this kind of thing as a species. And the physical evidence of that is works of art. And I went to a wonderful exhibition at the British Museum 2 or 3 years ago of Ice Age art. And there were a whole series of little figures, of female figures carved out of animal tusks and bones and things like that. Very, very detailed observations of the different stages of pregnancy and things like that. And you've got this feeling of people thinking about, you know, where we're coming from, what birth and pregnancy and all that sort of thing means and expressed in this art. So that's really, I think, you know, that's not an arbitrary point to start the book. That is where the first, you know, the first art that we can really call art comes from.
And do you think it's maybe a problem or maybe there's a sort of challenge in talking to people about this topic in this way, in that, again, myself included, I might have really put that kind of period more under a banner of something like archaeology, ancient history, you know, and I don't think of it specifically as, you know, these works in caves as being art. I think of them more like kind of evidence of existence.
Well, you know, we think these people lived so long ago, they must have been very different from us, but actually they weren't. You know, they were very, their brains were just like our brains. I mean, they didn't have all the stuff to work with that we've got, the technology and the accumulated knowledge of centuries, but they thought, they must have thought and lived their family lives and all the rest of it in very similar ways. And, you know, I live near the seaside and next week I'll go down to the beach and there'll be families sitting around digging holes in the sand and making sandcastles and being their natural selves. You know, there is something in all of us that wants to make things and explore and see what happens if we do this. And I wanted that feeling to run right the way through the book. You know, this is where art comes from. And of course, art history has these categories like the Middle Ages or the Renaissance or, you know, and so on. But these are categories. They're not the way that artists think. If you're in the studio, if you're in the workshop making something, you know, you don't think, I'm a Renaissance artist. I ought to approach it this sort of way. So I wanted the book to really be about the moment of making, you know, the mess, the accidents, the children coming into the studio, the animals running around. All this is part of artists' lives. And all right, you know, we don't know what Rembrandt said to his wife when he was painting her portrait as Flora. We don't know whether or not there was a cat running around in the monastery when Andrei Rublev was painting his icons.
There probably was, inevitably.
What art historian is going to prove me wrong?
Do you think there's a sort of a maybe quite useful duality there in the fact that this book, I mean, this book is for anyone. It's for anyone with an interest. I mean, there's so much information in there that
I'm pleased,
as an adult had no awareness of, so I'm sure a child has plenty to learn in there. But do you think there's a kind of nice duality there about maybe the point you're maybe trying to make across the whole book about art being this playful, expressive thing, and also this sort of maybe childlike way that you're trying to get younger people interested in art in general? I mean, there is something that serves both there, isn't there? Reminding adults that it's
fine. I'm really pleased that the French translation calls this, you know, a history of art explained for everyone.
Tom Hall there speaking to Michael Bird about his new book, Vincent Starry Night and Other Stories. This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
This week, the UK has been blessed with a rare sight on these isles, sun. As such, we've been piling into our parks and green spaces with gay abandon. So finally on the Weekly today, we thought we'd talk about the history of parks, both here and further afield, with Travis Elborough, who we welcome back to the show.
Travis's latest book, A Walk in the Park, The Life and Times of a People's Institution, celebrates the stories that helped create some of our favourite open spaces. And he's here now to tell us all about it. Travis, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Good to have you with us. Tell us a bit about A Walk in the Park. Is this a history of parks? Is it a history of people's relationship with them? Is it a social work? Is it a geographical piece? Give us the brief overview, first of all.
It's a wayward history of parks.
Wayward.
It's a social history, but it also explores their place in, you know, pop culture and in films. It involves a lot of, you know, wandering around in parks for research. So yeah, it offers many things, shall we say.
I like that. That's a good sell for the book, isn't it? Essentially, I'm not going to tell you what it's about. It's basically amazing.
Go and buy it. Yeah.
So how do we think we know how to define a park. But how do we define a park? Because is it something that was left over from being a country estate, or what was a country estate that now finds itself in the realms of a city? Is it something that was built on purpose for sort of public consumption? How do you define it, I wonder, Travis?
It's all of those things and a combination of them as well is deeply unhelpful.
So it makes it tricky today.
Exactly, yeah, sorry. The roots in the word park comes from the sort of Anglo-Norman French for an enclosure for the beasts of the chase. Effectively, it was an area that would be fenced off.
So this isn't an agricultural thing, this is a thing for gentlemen of leisure to go.
Exactly. A practical means of killing animals for the table and for sport. And, you know, in our words for sports being, you know, game, also being a type of animal that you would kill. There have been various forms of park landscape. I mean, in the literature, the earliest recorded reference to a park type of landscape is in the Sumerian epic, the Epic of Gilgamesh. So it kind of goes right back. And from that Sumerian concept, you get the Sumeria was conquered by the Persians, so they, you know, embellished the concept a bit, and so you get the walled garden and also the idea of paradise, this idea of Eden. And the sort of Judeo-Christian idea of paradise being a garden can be almost directly traced back to that. And then, you know, as time moves on, the gardens become about aristocratic show. So the planting is as important as the sport, the ability to be able to hunt animals. And from that, it kind of evolves in, as you alluded to, the kind of aristocratic estate. You know, gentlemen would hire, you know, gardeners like Capability Brown to kind of revamp their estate in the fashionable style of the day. So that's one form of what we have the roots of the public park, has its origins in some of those landscape parks. But then there were things like private pleasure gardens, things like Vauxhall Gardens on the south of
and
the
this
Thames.
This is very much the sort of communal municipal idea of the...
Yeah, I mean, well, Vauxhall was a commercial enterprise, so that's much more like a theme park or a fun fair. And then from that, you get a kind of merging of the two with the public park. And really, public parks don't... I mean, there are precursors. There are things like the Boston Common in the States, and actually, you know, areas of common land where festivities and market gardens and some freedom of access was allowed. There's these sort of pincer movements in a way. You have the agricultural revolution, which means that some of those areas of green open space, which, you know, revels and other solitary acts would be going on are enclosed for farming or for country estates. And then at the other end, you've got industrialization, industrial revolution, which means that more of the land is taken up by factories and houses and so on. And really by the 1830s, this is becoming something of a crisis.
These areas have to be defined against smoke and the
precisely. And essentially, those areas of green space are being lost. And so there's a campaign led by a famous gardener called John Claudius Loudon, who bangs the drums for public parks. And by the 1840s, he's actually given the chance to design one of the first, which is the Derby Arboretum up in Derby, which is a collection of trees. And this is another element of the public park, is the Arboretum had this collection of about 1,000 trees. All the trees were labelled. So there's this idea that you move through this landscape, and not only are you getting the goodness from, you know, the verdure, you know, and trees are always kind of godly, aren't they, because they kind of reach up into the heavens and, you know, and so on and so forth. You also learn stuff about them. So they have this pedagogical edge, and that thing, particularly in the Victorian era, this idea of improving, the idea that you're improving the landscape because you're creating these rather nice landscaped parks where there might be waste grounds or it might be being about to be built on, and also you're improving the morals by providing rational, what was referred to as rational recreation, rather than, you know, betting on a pugilistic fight in a pub garden or something.
That was a good answer, wasn't it? We went from Gilgamesh to Vauxhall Pleasure Gardens.
That's not really good.
You did that in 30 seconds, and then that's amazing.
What about some of the conflicts in modern parks? Because you talked there about lots of these pressures, you know, whether it's through, you know, the industrial age or so on, and parks now, particularly if we look at them in their urban, contemporary urban setting, they're talked about and discussed as public utilities, essentially.
Yeah.
But people often complain about them being overly managed, or they're too heavy-handed in the good work they're supposed to do. I don't know. As you stroll around, the modern city, do you still see parks doing the loftier work that you've described in history?
Yeah, I mean, there are certain things. I mean, certainly, to go back to the idea of the Derby Arboretum with its, you know, its name tags on trees, you have nature trails, you have, Victoria Park in East London has, you know, you can do a tour of its oldest trees and so on. So, and I suppose that what's happened in a way is that some contemporary parks are doing different environmental stuff with them. In the Victorian Park, actually, they're almost industrial spaces as well, because the trees are often grown in greenhouses. Some of this phenomena called carpet bedding, these elaborate beds of flowers are grown in greenhouses. And those are quite actually intensive industrial processes to create these things. Whereas now you have a move towards kind of environmentally neutral plants, what's known as wildscapes, you know, reclaiming other bits of green space in that way. But you're certainly right about there's a tension between the civic and the commercial, certainly in our contemporary parks. I think that's one of the major conflicts of the current moment, is because parks, rather like public libraries in Britain anyway, are non-mandatory services, so they have to fight for their budgets, and so they're coming under pressure to be able to supply some of their needs. But also it's how we have used parks has changed radically. I mean, the Victorian Park and the Edwardian Park, the main thing was the promenade, you know, walking through them. And therefore, you know, the grass, this joke we always have about, you know, keep off the grass signs,
you didn't need to ask people because they didn't want to get on there.
You didn't have much choice. You'd be fenced, the grass would be fenced off, so you wouldn't have access to it anyway. Things like even particular types of sports, there's an element of certain games are allowed in public parks. Victoria Park, for example, didn't allow football until the 1880s. If you wanted to play football in that area of East London, you had to go to Hackney Marshes. Similarly, Hyde Park in London didn't allow bicycles because they were considered in conflict with the horses and the carriages that used it. So Battersea Park, which allowed the riding of bicycles, became a mecca for cyclists. And so on. So these things, and, you know, certain parks today around the country, some will allow cycling, some won't. Some have to have dogs on leads. Barbecues are a huge bone of contention among many parks. So, you know, in a way, what happens is that I think it's one of the wonders and the amazing things about parks, actually, is that they are areas of tamed wildness. And as I've suggested, historically, they were used to tame wildness of the population. We claim them as our own spaces. And it's always there's always a push and pull between how, you know, how we access and how we use our public spaces in that way.
Travis, what about the status of parks? I mean, around the world, there's obviously, again, to come back to this idea of tensions between, whether it's between, you know, city and country or pressure on space in places. Is this sort of, are parks valued universally enough that their very future is safe? Whether that's, the, you know, the national park on that kind of scale or the, you know, the pocket park at the end of your street. Do you think that now it's in the common parlance, it's in
pocket
the vernacular?
Park.
Yeah, that's those little small areas where you go.
Sounds rude.
Yep. Such a dirty mind. But is there a universal appreciation of parks, I guess?
Yes and no. I mean, I think on the whole, there is a universal understanding of their value. But, I mean, when I was starting this book, I mean, one of the motives for writing the book was that in Istanbul, in Takim Square, the area which is Gezi Park, was under threat about being turned into a shopping mall. So there are certainly many cases around the globe. And again, in Britain at the moment, with the sort of cuts, and this is also, some of this is also happening in the United States as well, the impetus to involve commercial companies to run some of the park facilities, and even in some cases in local authorities, I mean, Bexley, the borough of London, has agreed to sell off a couple of green spaces. Sefton in Liverpool is in the process of selling a section of one of its parks to a developer for housing in order to raise funds to support the other green works. So there's always these balance, and certainly we have things like many music festivals in public parks, and obviously the cost of staging them is offset against some of the repairs and provides the local council and so on with money, but while it's on, people don't have access to them. So there are these tensions, shall we say. And another impetus for writing the book was I went to Lake Havasu City to visit the transplanted London Bridge. And I interviewed the guy who'd been the editor on the local paper during that era. And he was talking about Lake Havasu and that no one had really thought to build a public park. There just wasn't one. Because it was a new town type creation. And somehow or other, it kind of on the list of things to be built, they'd forgotten about it. And similarly, if you look at the Monopoly Board, there is no park on the Monopoly Board. So, you know, it's interesting to think about how relatively recent, actually, it is a feature of kind of urban design. And it's also interesting that a lot of town planners, earliest town planners, began as park designers. So there's an interesting correlation between those two disciplines historically. There is definitely a kind of interesting correlation between thinking about our urban space and its greenness and landscape and those correlations. But we live in times where, with so much pressure on land, particularly in cities now that cities have become much more desirable places to live, parks are an asset. You know, people want to live near a park. But there have been occasions when parks, you know, are almost notorious for being no-go areas, and therefore people don't want to live near them because they are associated with, you know, violence or homeless or kind of, you know, drug addicts or all sorts of other kind of nefarious activities.
What's your poison? Are you a walker? Are you a promenader? Are you a rollerblader? How do you best to enjoy a park? Are you a Sunday morning stroller? Tell us about your favourite park experience before you go, Travis.
I'm definitely a walker. I mean, I stray from the path, I think. I think that's the main thing to do. It's not, I mean, there's a whole, this great phrase, desire lines, which are where essentially the park users themselves will end up creating a fresh path by dint of stepping off the standard path to pursue where they really want to go. And I kind of greatly admire that. I think that's a kind of one of the great pleasures of park going is being able to amble and being able to kind of take it at your own pace.
It's a wonderful story, beautifully told, as ever, by Travis Elborough. The book is called Park Life. No, it's not. It's called A Walk in the Park. We were going to play that, but then we thought it was going to sell your story
cheaply. It's purposely absent from the book. Whatever joy I may have had from that song once has drained away far too long ago.
The author is Travis Elborough. The book is A Walk in the Park, and it does not contain a single mention of the word pork life. And that's it, Tom. Edition 373 of the Monocle Weekly. Another one bites the dust. Nice to see Travis Elborough. You know what I mean? He's a bit Austin Powers, isn't he?
Absolutely. And Rob, the laughter really peels when you make your gags, doesn't it? How do you feel involving your little magic sound machine has fared in the Monocle
Weekly? I've been having it in the office for 5 years. I can't believe it's finally gotten on the radio.
It's cropped up on a couple of our news programmes this week somehow. I think the Monocle Weekly is a far richer sonic experience for a couple of audio aids.
Thanks to everybody. Thanks to all our wonderful guests.
What a show. Can I just say, I've been inspired by this week's Monocle Weekly.
I have. What have you been inspired to do?
I am going to walk through a park, promenade maybe, whilst listening to classical music.
Yeah, okay.
And then I'll get home a bit tired and read about the history of art to my child.
That's good. See, you've ticked all... everything has basically been aimed...
Triple threat. 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, exactly. Everything has been aimed almost specifically for you. We hope, obviously, it's been aimed specifically for our listeners as well. I'm sorry for
I forget about that sound effects box.
So thank you to everybody, and thank you to our team behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and researched by Jimena Miñan. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monocle Weekly will be back at the same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.